This is KUNC's Colorado Edition. I'm Carly Huckles.
And I'm Erin O'Toole. Colorado turned 142 this week.
142 years of awesome.
I think we can all agree on that. But it is also a time to reflect on how we've made it to where we are now.
How can we know where we're going unless we know where we've been?
And who better to talk to about that than the new head of the State Historians Council, also known as Dr. Colorado.
Then we take a look at how Colorado is lifting the label and trying to remove the invisible barrier that keeps some opioid users from seeking treatment.
I never set out to become a heroin addict or anything like that. It just slowly happened one day at a time, you know, until I found myself where I was.
And later, musicians often take inspiration from nature. But what if the landscape itself could play music? We meet one researcher who's handing classical instruments over to rivers and letting them play.
And, of course, we get to hear a new review from our film critic, Howie Mofsovitz.
But first, a series of severe thunderstorms tore through parts of northeastern Colorado this week, spawning tornadoes and golf ball-sized hail, knocking over trees and power lines, and even flipping over some small planes. It was crazy.
Yeah.
KUNC's Desmond O'Boyle has the story.
The storm, which the National Weather Service calls a supercell storm, originated in southeastern Wyoming and made it all the way to Texas before it dissipated. There was damage done to small planes at the Brush Airport and reports of trucks knocked over on Interstate 76. Now, a Weather Service team is heading in to assess the damage from hail and reported tornado sightings. Meteorologist David Bargenbrook says the data collected will be used to help predict future storms and the damage they cause.
We can compare, you know, certain weather patterns and what happened, let's say, in a tornadic outbreak maybe 20 years ago or 30 years ago. And then we can database that and see how likely the next particular storm, when we see the same weather patterns develop, how likely it is for tornadoes and or high winds or destructive hail to occur.
The team will survey damage across Morgan and Washington counties in northeastern Colorado.
August 1st, 1876, President Ulysses S. Grant. Those three things together can only mean one thing, Colorado Day. It marks the day Grant officially proclaimed Colorado the 38th state.
And if you've ever wondered why we're nicknamed the Centennial State.
I know I have.
Well, that is because Colorado became a state 100 years after the signing of the Declaration of Independence back in 1776.
That is so cool.
Isn't that neat? Well, one thing Colorado has always been known for is the great outdoors. So what better way to celebrate Colorado Day than with a story of hunting in what many people call the state's crown jewel, Rocky Mountain National Park. But it's not the kind of hunting you're probably thinking of.
What other kinds of hunting are there?
Well, KUNC's Michael DeJuana produced this audio postcard. It begins with Jacob Job, who's a research associate at Colorado State University, describing his search for elk on a cool autumn morning with his assistant Carlos Linares. And they were armed not with rifles, but with microphones.
The Moraine Park is on the east side of the park. It's one of the first sort of features that you'll come to once you enter the park. And it's this big, flat meadow expanse that is surrounded on all sides by mountains. It's a hot spot for birds, but during the fall, it's sort of one of the convergence zones for a lot of the elk. It absolutely is like hunting without a firearm, except my firearm are microphones, and I'm just capturing the sounds of what's going on. My prey is sound, and I take it home with me on memory cards. Carlos and I woke up at 4:30. Carlos is my field assistant. He is a student that works in the listening lab at Colorado State University. We quickly packed everything up, walked down the trail, set the microphones as far into the meadow that we could before there's a river there, a really swampy area. And so it just felt right to me, even though it wasn't light out yet. It's still dark, but we can hear animals on three sides of us, and behind us is a mountain, and we knew they weren't going to be coming from that direction. I had no clue we were there because the wind was blowing into our face. Carlos was behind a tree. He was sort of positioned to where he could just see out the one side, and then I was behind a fallen log. And we just sat, hit record, and what happened next was nothing short of magic. It's still dark, but we can hear elk on all three sides of us slowly getting closer. And eventually the sun starts to come up and we start to see that, you know, these elk are within 75, 100 yards. Two of the males just lock antlers and start fighting, and you can hear the antlers banging into each other. They're breaking willow trees over. You can hear the splashing of the water, the suction of their feet in the muddy ground. Eventually, one of the males was a winner. He was so charged up, he continued to chase all the females even closer to us until eventually they got to within 15, 17 yards, which is really close. This low, guttural glug, this glug, 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 you don't get to hear it that often. A, it's not that loud of a sound, and B, it's only when they're really worked up and they've got a bunch of females that are sort of corralling. The females abruptly turned back towards the center of the meadow, which was a great thing because all of a sudden the sort of the threat towards us was moving away from us, and that's as close as they got. They sort of turned around, and but as soon as that happened, 30 yards over our back shoulder, we could hear all of a sudden a coyote start barking. Females saw the coyote, were so threatened or unsure about it, they started giving this really loud alarm bark, which I'd never heard of it. It's so loud. And so you've got all of this going on, and it was just like a perfect storm of natural sounds right there, and all of this without any sort of interruption from vehicles, from aircraft overflights, from people. I mean, it was ours, and you just don't get that very often.
That was CSU Research Associate Jacob Job talking about his work recording wildlife sounds at Rocky Mountain National Park. KUNC's Michael DeJoanna produced that piece.
Let's keep this Colorado Day celebration going.
Woo.
But we'll move it inside to a new exhibit from History Colorado that highlights unique moments from the centennial state. KUNC arts and culture reporter Stacey Nick met up with the new state historian Tom Noel, also known as Dr. Colorado.
So it just makes sense that I meet with CU Denver history professor Tom Noel, a.k.a. Dr. Colorado, at the History Colorado Center's Zoom In exhibit. Each of the 100 objects, from the Native American pottery of Mesa Verde to John Denver's guitar, tells a part of the state's story.
Most people know the story of Molly Brown, this poor Irish girl who marries well and then educates herself and becomes quite a booster, a promoter for Colorado. Most famous for the Titanic story. But here, in 100 objects, we have, guess what? Molly Brown's opera cape. We also have these Crocs. I'm not sure if Molly Brown wore those to the opera or not.
No, the pair of very pink plastic shoes from the Niwot-based company definitely wouldn't have matched the fur-collared cape. But that's part of the fun of Colorado's eclectic, sometimes eccentric history, Noel says, as we stand in front of a pair of long rubber gloves.
Oh, and isn't this kind of weird-looking, the Rocky Flats Nuclear Facility Lab, the anti-contamination gloves that they wore there.
As we walk past the point of a spear that dates Colorado's earliest resident at 13,000 years ago, we talk about the state's other population booms and busts.
The gold rush, of course, is a part of this exhibit. This was the Changed Colorado Forever, of course. It had been a place for Native Americans and a few Spanish in the San Luis Valley. This brings in 100,000 people in just 1859, 1860, one of the great mass migrations in American history.
And while it isn't part of this exhibit, when I asked Noel what the oddest bit of local lore is, he says it's definitely another story from around this same time.
That's got to be Alfred Packer, who took prospectors into the mountains and returned all by himself, explaining that they died of starvation, but he had kind of this fat, greasy look to his face.
It turns out Packer may have resorted to cannibalism.
And then he was sentenced to death with the famous words, which aren't actually true, but it's too good a story to pass up. Packer, you man-eating son of a... There are only 7 Democrats in Hinsdale County, and you had 5 of them!
But while it may be one of the oddest moments, it's not Noel's favorite. That distinction goes to the progressive era of the early 1900s. It was a time of social activism and political reform around the country that had a big impact on Colorado.
When Mayor Spear in Denver, for instance, is transforming a dusty, drab, ordinary city into Paris on the Platte, into a city beautiful. How you can transform cities, how you can solve a lot of social problems by planning, putting in a great civic center, Greek theater, attention on the public sector, on public education, on libraries, on beautiful cities, beautiful environments.
To Noel, history is a chance to look back on those moments and learn from them.
How can we know where we're going unless we know where we've been? And I think we have so many newcomers, so many people moving into the state that they need an introduction.
Since 1924, History Colorado has appointed a state historian to work with the organization to preserve, interpret, and share Colorado's past. Last month, the group announced a new State Historians Council.
We have Nikki Gonzalez, a great Hispanic historian from Regis University, William Way from Boulder, very much interested in Asian history, Dwayne Vandenbush representing the Western Slope, which often is left out, and Jared Orsi of CSU, Fort Collins.
He said that last name with a little bit of a laugh because he almost forgot to mention him. It actually speaks to the reason Noel says having more experts from all across Colorado was important.
One of the things we struggle with at History Colorado is not being Denver-centric, but trying to represent the whole state.
Whether you're a transplant or a native, you can learn more about Colorado history, as well as meet several members of the new State Historians Council, today on Colorado Day, at the History Colorado Center in Denver. For KONC, I'm Stacey Nick.
You can find out more about Colorado Day and see pictures of some of the items from History Colorado's exhibit Zoom In, the Centennial State in 100 Objects, on our website, kunc.org.
All right, buckle up. There are more great stories coming up. And don't worry, not all of them are about how awesome Colorado is.
Even though we can all agree that it is the best state.
Absolutely, don't tell the other states.
Hearing the statement, "Let's go hiking," makes boots magically appear on my feet like some animated children's movie.
Crazy.
But what really gets me and a lot of other people, so I've heard, are the sounds of nature.
Mm.
We get the pleasure of hearing how some people have turned the wonderful sounds of a river into a symphony.
I hear a heartbeat of violas and violins and piccolos and cellos.
I can't wait for that. And we still have yet to hear about the movie Three Identical Strangers. But before we get too ahead of ourselves, last year, Colorado received nearly $16 million from the federal government to address prevention, treatment, and recovery for the growing opioid epidemic. Now, a small part of that grant funds the Lift the Label campaign. This aims to remove an invisible barrier that keeps some opioid users from seeking treatment. KUNC's Stephanie Daniel has more.
You couldn't miss the opioid memorial wall when it was on display inside the state capitol in May. Attached to the front are 4,200 pill bottles. They represent the 42,000 Americans who died from opioid overdoses in 2016. Messages are written on the bottles, like,
judgment can be a death sentence,
and
you don't have to face opioid addiction alone, which is something we really want to get across through this campaign.
That's Liz Owens. She works for the State Office of Behavioral Health.
Some of the other messages talk about addiction as a brain disorder, because we really want to move away from people thinking that it's a moral failing or that it's a lack of willpower, which is what surveys tell us that people think about opioid addiction.
The wall is part of the Lift the Label campaign. Launched in May, it aims to remove the stigma that prevents people with opioid addiction from accessing treatment.
40% of all U.S. opioid overdose deaths involved a prescription opioid, and then 80% of people who use heroin first misused opioids from a prescription.
I never set out to become a heroin addict.
One of those is 32-year-old Scott Kendall.
It just slowly happened one day at a time, you know, until I found myself where I was.
Kendall lives in Louisville with his wife and 2-year-old son. He began drinking at 12 before moving on to his mom's prescription pain pills at 14 and then finally heroin. Looking at him today, you'd never know that he almost died from his addiction.
I'm driving on I-70 with my right arm sticking out as he shoots me up for the first time as I'm going 60, 70 miles an hour down the road. And I just immediately pass out.
Luckily, he came to right before he crashed his car into a yellow barrel at an exit ramp. But it wasn't until he was 26 and served 4 months in jail that he decided to get sober.
The shame and guilt that's associated with addiction is, again, something that keeps people from getting help.
To help reduce the stigma of opioid abuse, Lift the Label enlisted Kendall and 14 other Coloradans to share their stories of addiction and recovery. It features men and women who range in age from 22 to 64 and from different backgrounds. 41-year-old Greeley resident Nathan Perot is also speaking out.
Hello.
Hi, Nathan.
Yep, Stephanie. Nice to meet you.
Come on in.
He became addicted to Percocet after a foot injury. He started taking methadone in January.
Methadone treatment is something that I really believe in. And one of the things that was the best thing about my recovery was my support system and how openly and easily I could talk about it.
One treatment for opioid addiction is medication-assisted treatment. Matt combines therapy and social services along with a medication, either methadone, buprenorphine, or naltrexone. But it's controversial because the medications are actually long-acting opioids. Critics say people who use them are just replacing one drug for another. Perot disagrees.
You're not getting high off the methadone. What you're doing is you're getting normal and you're healing.
And so do those who administer methadone and see its results firsthand.
People just don't understand it. They fear it. They don't know how it works.
Susan Kanamasu is the program director at Behavioral Health Group, a methadone center in Fort Collins. She says the stigma around the drug comes from a lack of education.
We want to have someone that's going to commit to treatment for about a year at least. At that point, if they're stable, if they're doing well, and if they wish, they can start tapering slowly off of the methadone.
Methadone is regulated by the Drug Enforcement Agency, and it can only be dispensed by opioid treatment programs or OTPs. There were 23 across Colorado. Nathan Perot says it gave him his life back.
I mean, I've been able to go back to work. I've taken over some responsibilities in my church. Relationship with my wife is better. Relationship with my kids is better. And they noticed the difference.
According to those behind the Lift the Label campaign, methadone and other medication-assisted treatments have a success rate of 60 to 90%. So the state wants to increase the usage of MAT by at least 25% by the end of 2019.
Foundry Treatment Center, this is Scott.
Back in Louisville, Scott Kendall is busy answering the phone. He's been sober for almost 7 years and works from home as the director of admissions and aftercare for the Foundry Treatment Center.
I'll light a little fire here, but we got the medical...
Kendall was a psychology major at CU Boulder. His education, combined with his experience with addiction and treatment, propelled him into this work.
That's kind of a big part of my passion here is finding the right programs that have the right specialties and the right circumstances for each person.
He and the others working on the Lift the Label campaign want people with opioid addiction to know support and treatment is out there. For KUNC, I'm Stephanie Daniel.
Stand near a river and you'll hear a symphony of sounds, birds chirping, frogs croaking, and water flowing. But what would it sound like if the stream itself could be transformed into classical music? KUNC's Luke Runyon found a researcher who's doing just that.
By day, Dave Merritt is a river ecologist for the U.S. Forest Service in Fort Collins, Colorado. By night, he's a musician. And one evening, he was messing around in his home recording studio.
And I was in my basement alone with my headphones on.
At the time, he was frustrated. He knows rivers are important, but making other people care is hard. And that's when it clicked. Merritt pulled up the flow data for his favorite river, the Yampa, in northwest Colorado, and funneled it through a program that turns numbers into musical notes.
And I absolutely got chills as I listened to the flood of 1984 in church organ.
He called his wife down, had her put on the headphones, and hit play. Those high notes represent the river's seasonal peak. The Yampa is dynamic, mostly fed by melting snow. The year we're listening to, 1984, was a record wet year. Soon, he started auditioning other rivers and trying out different instruments. When the rivers are low, the music is rhythmic and steady.
I hear a heartbeat of violas and violins and piccolos and cellos. Just a boom, 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 boom. And as a monsoon or a snowmelt hydrograph begins to form, you can hear other instruments picking up, and you can hear the rate of the playing of these instruments speed up and vary.
We've been measuring the flow of some Western rivers for more than a century, which Merritt says gives us the opportunity to hear how we've changed them. Take a river like the Green, which starts in Wyoming and snakes through Utah and Colorado. In 1962, the Green didn't have any large dams, and its flow hit lots of highs and lows. But just a few years later, the Flaming Gorge Dam was finished near the Wyoming-Utah border, and here's how it sounded after that.
Here's a river, and here's a river in its unaltered state, playing symphonies from year to year, and this is what it sounds like under regulated conditions. You know, it's undeniably different, and it's undeniably had an effect on the organisms in those systems, and this is a way for you to hear it and hopefully to feel it.
He says rivers in the West are meant to surge, either from snowmelt or monsoon rains, and not run steady year-round. The birds, fish, insects, and plant life that call rivers home have evolved to be in sync with a river's rhythm.
We are aware of the consequences of damming and diverting a vast majority of the streams in the West. Then I think society could rally behind protecting one or two.
Dave Merritt says he's not naive to the fact that dams are part of what make life in the West possible, storing water for later use. But now, we have the ability to manage our existing dams better and hold on to some of the last remaining free-flowing rivers, like the Yampa.
It's like a natural laboratory. It's something that we ought to treasure and protect like a piece of art or like a great symphony.
I'm Luke Runyon.
The new documentary, Three Identical Strangers, centers on triplets separated in infancy who encounter one another as teenagers. KUNC film critic Howie Mofshevitz teaches film and television at CU Denver. He says the movie tells a fascinating story, but doesn't go quite far enough.
At the start of Three Identical Strangers, Bobby Schaffran seats himself in front of a mottled blue background and looks straight at the camera. He's like a witness about to confess. He assures us that the story he's about to tell is true, even though if he weren't the teller, he wouldn't believe it. He's not lying on either count. His story has plenty of texture and plenty of mood changes, and by the end it leaves you stunned that people who claim good intentions could treat other people so callously. Schaffran is 56 at the time of filming. He was 19 when some fact of his life slapped him in the face. Through a bizarre series of events, Bobby Schaffran discovered that he was actually one of a set of triplets who'd been separated early in life and adopted out to three different families. One of his brothers had gone to the same college Bobby attended shortly afterwards. Students greeted him like an old friend until he eventually figured out that he was a twin. He found his brother, David Kelman, and then the two of them tracked down the third, Eddie Galland. At first, the movie goes playful with the brothers and others talking about amusing similarities among the three. And then things turn darker as the film reveals details about the separation of the brothers and the adoptions. The world faces serious problems about the confusion of truth and lies, so documentary films that claim truth have to be clear about what they're doing. Too many naive filmmakers think that to make a documentary, you point the camera and restage some events. That's the bind that director Tim Wardle chooses. He sets scenes with music that have the feel of fiction. As Bobby Schaffran describes going 100 miles an hour on the New York State Thruway to meet his brother David, feet stomp on the pedals of a car, a hand shifts gears. You get the idea of rushing, but it's fictional and distracting. The movie cuts to shots of traffic or crowded streets in Manhattan or shots of the ocean, and none of these bear on the matter of the documentary. The style suggests that director Wardle doesn't trust his material. The film has potent archival footage and photo imagery. It looks as if the three young men were on every talk show and television, and you can see how for a while they reveled in their celebrity and their sense of show business. They appear dressed identically. They answer questions in unison, like backup singers for a rock band. Yet the fun starts to look contrived. And over time, photos, home movies, and recent footage show the damage they suffered. Three Identical Strangers doesn't need the manipulative music or the reenactments, and Tim Wardle is no Errol Morris, who has always understood how to use fictional elements to sharpen the notion of truth and to make truth itself an object of search instead of an easy given. Three Identical Strangers reports the surface of the situation. It illuminates the smug injustice visited on these human beings and a few other pairs of twins brought into the film. In the 50s, some researchers investigated the nature-nurture question, how much of personality or behavior is inherited and how much is shaped by environment. Some researchers were willing to separate twins and triplets. These three were spied upon and interviewed without their knowledge. Bobby says they were guinea pigs. David says lab rats. And there were serious and unhappy consequences for these men who were denied knowledge of who they are, their family backgrounds, and of course the fact that they were set up for a heartless experiment without their permission. But Three Identical Strangers doesn't ask the next level of questions. A richer film might look beyond what people say to what they dream and what drives them. For KUNC, I'm Howie Mofshevitz.
This has been Colorado Edition. Our show this week was produced by me, Erin O'Toole.
And me, Carly Huckles. Editors Ashley Jeffcoat and Brian Larson contributed to our show. Ashley also manages digital.
Our intro music is Remember Me by Colorado musician Kalatana.
Other music in this episode is Daddy Scrabble with Flying Pea Version 1, Split Phase with Catching Glitter,
Broke for Free with Note Drop, Forest Robots with Follow the Towers to the Moon, and SRO, I Miss Summer. Our outro music is Good Grief by Ryan Little.
If you like what you're hearing, subscribe now so you will never miss an episode. We'll be back next week with more great stories for you.
Find Colorado Edition at KUNC.org or wherever you get your podcasts. And join us next Sunday evening at 9 on KUNC.